Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Apple Podcasts, Podcast One, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Welcome, you tuned into the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. I'm your host, Dave Schrader, along with me, Tim Dennis. And today we're revisiting with a friend. Steve Stockton is back. His book, Strange Things in the Woods, a collection of terrifying stories, has been re-released with new stories, updated pieces. He also has his book, My Strange World, which has come out. We'll have a link for both books on today's program. And you can find them, order them right through our Amazon link page that way. And from his early years, Steve Stockton has had what can be called strange and oftentimes frightening experiences with the paranormal and the unexplained. And these encounters led him to search for the answers, only to discover the truth isn't always easy to find. Steve, it's great to have you back. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, great to be here, Dave. Thanks for having me on again.
Well, I know you've got you dropped My Strange World back in April of this year, and then Strange Things in the Woods, a collection of terrifying tales, is April 11th as well. Two great books out and available for the public consumption. You say that your life has kind of had this strange stuff going on, and for listeners that aren't familiar with your story, at what point in your life did the supernatural and paranormal really become prevalent to you?
I would say I was around 5 or 6 years old and saw my first full body apparition, and it just kind of went from there. It didn't scare me as much as it piqued my interest, and just, you know, like, that's not supposed to happen. And it just evolved into a lifelong search, and haven't really found any answers, only found more questions. But I think that's just part of the journey, part of the fun.
At the age of 5, Steve, what type of activity was taking place around you?
I was in my front yard, and I saw a car coming down the street, and then what appeared to be a toddler ran out from behind the car, which had stopped at a stop sign at an inverted T intersection. The toddler ran around from behind the car across in front of the car, and it was obvious that the driver didn't see this kid, and I thought, that kid's going to get run over, so I started walking over that way. The kid runs kind of catty-cornered down into my yard. And have you ever noticed how little kids that haven't more than mastered walking, if they start running, they'll get kind of out of control and just fall down?
Right.
That's what this kid did, except instead of hitting the ground, he disappeared. Didn't take my eyes off the spot, went directly to it. There was nothing there, no kid, nothing I could have mistaken for a kid, no hole that a kid could have fallen into. But again, more than scare me, it was just like, you know, that's not supposed to happen. Kids don't run across the yard and disappear.
No, not often they don't. I know a couple I wish would disappear after running across my yard, but no, that's not normal at all. Well, you see that and have that type of encounter. I mean, how does that affect your perspective on the world and life in general?
Yeah, it made me aware that there are things that maybe everybody can see, or at least that I could see sometimes, that were not things other people could see. And my grandmother on my mother's side, who was a self-professed gypsy witch, she was into telling fortunes and reading tea leaves and coffee ground, and they held seances and things like that. I talked to her about it when I was a little bit older, and she said that's just the unseen world's way of letting you know that it's there, and that sometimes you'll see things.
So it's from your bloodline, this kind of ability to see and experience things.
Yeah, apparently so.
How long? I mean, was this something that your family has always cultivated?
In that respect, yes. They stopped it much later in life, but they were involved with the spiritualism movement around the turn of the last century. So that side of the family was quite steeped in it. From Appalachia, the Cades Cove area, the Great Smoky Mountains, and just all the lore and legends there. My grandmother had a story or a legend or a superstition for anything under the sun.
Did she see ghosts as well?
She did. She had, she called them visitations, and then they regularly did seances and table tapping and used the Ouija board and things like that. So, yeah, it was common for them and just accepted within that side of the family.
Was it stuff that ever got over her head, you know, things that maybe were a little too aggressive?
Not that I'm aware of, but there was a lot of things she just wouldn't talk about. There was some things she would openly discuss, some things she would hint at, and some things were just totally forbidden, and never really got into anything like that with her. I was actually afraid of her when I was a kid. She looked like your stereotypical witch, and she passed away when I was 13, and I wish I'd had more time with her when I wasn't afraid of her to have learned more of her ways and means and how she did things. But I did learn a lot from her.
Was she nurturing and supportive when you started having experiences?
Oh, she was. That made me the favorite grandchild. She had 10 kids, 9 boys and 1 girl. My mom was the girl. And out of all the grandkids, I was the only one, according to her, that had any kind of gift or anything. She claimed it was because I was born with a caul over my face. That's a Southern thing. And all it is when you're born, you have the amniotic sac still over your face or over your head.
Right. Veil.
But down south, that marks you. You're a special child. It's either blessing or a curse, but you're going to have different life experiences than other people, according to lore and superstition.
All right. Now, your experiences, I mean, you start with seeing this kind of ghost child. Were you ever able to track down a story behind that or who that child might have been?
No, and that was one of the things I did later in life. I searched. There'd never been a child killed at that intersection or anybody on that street even that had died that matched that description. Just a little blonde-haired boy wearing blue shorts and suspenders and a little ball cap, white shoes. I mean, to see it just as plain in my mind today as when it happened, but no clue what it was or what it meant. That was another thing that Granny was big on. There was certain things were signs or portents or foretelling of something that was going to happen, but I don't know what that one was other than just letting me know that things are not always as they seem.
So once that kind of Pandora's box opened for you, how often would you have strange experiences?
It seems like on a regular basis. I mean, there was always something going on. That whole area where I grew up, it just seemed off. There was a phantom motorcyclist that was seen in the area, a guy that had been decapitated in a car accident. And that did happen. And just a lot of spooks and legends in that area. And so I wasn't the only one having these experiences, but I was seeking them out. And that's how these stories came about. I was a much older in life, unexpected baby. So when I was a kid, a lot of my friends' parents were, I said that wrong. A lot of my friends' grandparents were the age of my parents. So I'd go to visit with my folks and, you know, their friends were all old and all the other kids were grown, so I'd be the only child around. And when there was a lull in the conversation, I would, you know, tell me a story, tell me a ghost story. Do you know any legends? And it just kind of grew out of that. And a few years ago, when I sat down and decided to start writing them out, found that I had enough to fill a book.
All right. Well, let's examine some of the. I don't know if you want to call them cultural legends from that area, but, you know, what are two or three of the, you know, you talked about the phantom motorcycle rider and such, but what are some of the other strange stories that really seemed, you know, unique to your area?
Well, the one that I opened the book with is called The Flying Organ, and that happened to a couple of my relatives back in the late 1930s. They lived and worked on a farm. They're kids. They'd done their chores for the day. And they go down to the creek to kind of cool off, and they heard what sounded like a church organ overhead. Now, this was a clear day. They're out in the absolute middle of nowhere over in Middle Tennessee, which that area, their farm, backed up into the Big South Fork National Recreation Area, which is on the Kentucky side, but it's absolute wilderness out there. And there's no church or nobody with an organ for miles and miles, but they heard it, they listened to it, and it passed directly overhead and then went on up the hollow that they were in and spoke to them for sure. And they could recognize that it was playing a tune, but they didn't recognize the tune. And that again, that area in Middle Tennessee, Fentress County, it's steeped in lore and legend. There's
That's just a bizarre. I mean, you're very nonchalant about that. I mean, that's a really weird experience. Period, Dev. I mean, and how many people had had that?
Yeah, that's there was a couple others that had heard it, and in the same area, there were some little girls that saw a coffin, a wooden pine coffin, floating along a railroad track. No train, no nothing under it, just kind of moving along. And a few days later, a lady that lived the direction that the coffin was going passed away suddenly, and they thought maybe that was some sort of foretelling of her death. That's another thing that you get into, particularly in Appalachia, you know, the deaths and things like that. If you know what to look for, there are supposedly signs and forewarnings.
So you get these kind of precognitive visions of up and coming deaths?
Not necessarily visions, but when you observe something, or one of my granny's favorites was a calendar falling off the wall. Anytime a calendar fell off the wall, it meant somebody was going to pass away. And I observed that happen several times. I've been at her house and hear the calendar in the kitchen fall off the wall. And usually within a week or two, somebody in the, not necessarily the immediate family, but the extended family would pass away. And in fact, when she was sick right before she died, I was staying at her house helping take care of her. And one night I heard the calendar fall, and she died within 2 weeks. So coincidence? Who knows? But just to be on the safe side, I don't hang any calendars in my house.
Yeah. Well, you know, that doesn't stop deaths from happening, right? I'd right. like that precursor, kind of get that concept of what's coming on. Are these individualistic kind of legends, like, the, you know, it seems every medium gets specific signs that mean something to them. Was that a, you know, something like the calendar falling off the wall? Was that just a generally accepted legend of that area, or just one that was prominent to your family or to your grandmother?
It was more prominent in my family and to my grandmother, but it was also kind of a Southern thing too. A picture falling off the wall can have the same meaning. And just the older people like that, they used to observe the signs, they called it. They would watch for signs, and that was going to let them know what was coming up. It wasn't always something bad. It could be something good, too. One of the other things my grandmother did, in addition to fortune-telling and stuff, she read animal entrails. Now, I know that sounds strange.
Wait a minute, but, what?
She read animal entrails.
Hold on 1 second. Do me a favor here, just to give us a kind of a concept. I've heard of people reading tea leaves or coffee grounds, reading the bones, you know, looking for these scents. I mean, do you understand how that works? And if so, could you give us a little background? Like, when we'll get to the entrails in a minute, but reading tea leaves and coffee grounds, talk to me about that.
Yeah, that's it. Again, it's an interpretive thing, kind of like tarot cards. The person would, she'd make him a cup of tea or a cup of coffee. If it was coffee, it had to have the grounds in it. And then after they drank it down, she would swirl the leftovers around, flip it upside down on a saucer. And then lifting the saucer up, she would see things. It's almost like a form of scrying, or to me, looking at the clouds. You know, you can look at the clouds, you can see a bear, you can see a bunny rabbit. Well, she could look at the coffee grounds or the tea leaves and see things in there, and then it was up to her to interpret what those things meant based on the person. So it's not very scientific at all. But the animal entrails, they butchered their own hogs, and every year at slaughter time, she would pick one hog, and when that one was butchered, she would want to look at its insides, and through that, she would foretell what kind of season they were going to have next year, not only with the meat, but with the farm in general, all the crops. She could tell if it was going to be a good growing season, or again, there might be some science in there, but it's beyond me. But I was doing research on that once and found out that that's something that dates back to the Vikings and maybe before, that they would slaughter an animal and study the insides before going into battle to tell how easy a victory might be. So I guess that one's been passed around for a long, long time.
And that's by reading the entrails of this. Yeah. Do you believe that these things, the tea leaves, the coffee grounds, the entrails, do you believe that they really were what shared the story? Or do you believe that it was, and I don't use this impolitely, but as a crutch? You know, I've found that some of my friends that are tarot readers are very intuitive and sensitive. Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like they use the cards to tell the story that they're picking up on psychically. And that way it's kind of like, hey, you know, Steve, you flip the cards. You're the one that shuffled or whatever, you know, they can keep the blame in place of, hey, I'm just telling you what these things say, but they're actually just sharing the message that they're getting. And they're using something like entrails, tea leaves or coffee grounds or bones or whatever to be like their focal tool to allow their psychic intuition to kind of kick in.
Oh, absolutely. And I've read tarot cards before. And the way I looked at it, I knew a lot of times what the cards were going to say before they said it, but then it would come up in the cards. But it's like you said, it's the cards are something concrete that's used to explain an abstract concept. I mean, if somebody just came in and sat down and you'd say, okay, this and this and this and this, they're thinking, yeah, right. But if it, you know, you run the cards and it shows in the cards, then that's something for them to work that abstract concept around, to get their head around it. So yeah, I think you have to have a certain degree of empathic or intuitiveness to be able to do it. And it's not the cards or it's not the bones. She did that too. She threw bones, but it's how that's interpreted, and not so much a crutch, but just a means to explain it to somebody else that maybe doesn't understand the concept.
Gotcha. All right. Fascinating stuff. I mean, and this is just kind of the lifestyle you grew up in. Was this kind of the belief of many people, or was your family?
I think we were a little exceptional and held on to their hillbilly, as I like to say, but it's prevalent in certain areas of the South, particularly in the Southern Appalachians, in the mountains, Great Smoky Mountains, in that area on down into Georgia, that part of the Appalachian Trail. The folk beliefs and the folklore and the folk magic is very big and still is to some degree. It's just not as open as it used to be, I think.
Were there things that you were taught to make this ability stronger or to understand it and control it better?
Not really, other than just practice, that it was like anything. The more you do it, the better you'll get at it. And you can, if you're the least bit intuitive, you can hone that in by using it. You know, it's like a muscle. The more you work it, the better, the stronger it gets.
But was your family pretty open about these abilities and the things that you could see and do?
It would depend on the company present. If it was just family, it was, you know, talked about more openly than it would be around strangers. But I mean, everybody in the community knew my grandmother, knew what she did, and she was the one they came to if they had questions about life, love, or money.
Unbelievable. Now, let's talk about you growing up then with these abilities. Were you open with friends about what you could do and with your friends' parents, or was this something you kind of kept to yourself?
I've always been introverted when it comes to that, so I pretty much kept it to myself. If it was something I could do to help someone, or if someone came to me and asked a question, you know, I would be happy to share any insight or intuition that I had into it. And I don't claim to be psychic or anything like that. I think I'm just in tune with some part of nature that's there that I believe human beings have kind of lost the ability, that most people don't know that they're able to do these things. But I think at one time we had some sort of hive mind, or, you know, I'm getting off into string theory and things like this here. But I think all things are connected in some way. And if you know how to listen, there's a lot of things that will talk to you out there. But, yeah, I just sort of always kept to myself unless, you know, somebody asked me, that I was never one to volunteer anything. And especially, you know, later years, teenage years in high school and things, you're kind of a weirdo if you're expressing any interest or any fascination with things like that. But years later, you know, just I came to accept it. It is what it is. I make no apologies for it, and I am the way I am.
Steve Stockton, our guest, My Strange World, his book, and Strange Things in the Woods, a collection of terrifying tales, are the books that we're talking about and discussing right now, his real-life encounters and life growing up with these abilities. You take this forth, you know, and you're keeping it to yourself, these kind of abilities that you've got. I mean, you're able to share it with your family, but did it ever make you feel isolated and strange among the normals, you know?
Absolutely. I was always an outsider among the outsiders anyway. In high school, I hung mainly with like the punk and the goth kids, but it was because they would accept anybody and they didn't judge anybody, even though I wasn't really into any of that either. But yeah, it's, you know, you recognize that you're different, that you see things differently, you experience things differently. And so just if you embrace it and make the most of it, then it's not that bad. But it can be, you know, potentially socially embarrassing, I guess. I mean, I've had dates before, and I had a girl that wanted me to take her someplace haunted, and I did, and it scared her to death, and that was the only date we had. So she asked for a haunted date, and I delivered, and she couldn't handle it.
Do you, you know, when you're around your friends and people like that, I mean, would you see precognitions or see the spirits of their family members trying to pass messages on?
It has happened on occasion. I used to use a Ouija board a lot, and I would sometimes get messages purporting to be from friends, relatives. Now, I don't know how much stock you put in it. I think that's an individual thing, but that has happened occasionally. But it seems like for really close friends or family members that there's kind of a block or something there. It's I get more info off of strangers and about people that I don't really know that well.
And, okay, now you start honing this skill, this craft, and what is that like? I mean, do you start getting overwhelmed by strange, anomalous creatures, spirits, aliens? You know, I don't know exactly what type of things then make themselves known. Can you give us a little insight into that?
Yeah, it can be overwhelming. It can be very strange, especially when you're first figuring out, you know, that you experience these things. But I finally got to a point where I kind of take it in stride. And I don't know if it's things that are attracted to me or if I just happen to go to places that have a lot of activity, but I don't think I've ever lived in a house that wasn't haunted to some degree.
Do you believe the house was haunted? Or, Steve, do you believe that you turned the light on in that house and the ghosts came to you like moths to a flame?
Yeah, that's kind of the analogy that I've had described to me before, that's what it is, that they sense that you're able to communicate or at least able to notice them, and they're drawn to you. So it's not necessarily the property, although it can be. I mean, I've been in places where everybody had experiences there, but said I have something strange happen just about anywhere I go. There'll be, you know, unexplained knocks or whispers or and any number of things can happen.
What, I mean, you've had a lot of experiences in your life. What have been some of the most chilling experiences?
The scariest one, and this is in My Strange World, the story is called The Thing in the Ditch. And this happened when I was 8 years old. We lived on a 26-acre small farm in rural East Tennessee. And I was out one day on our property just kind of meandering around in the woods, and there was a ditch near one border of the property. And I'd walked up to the ditch and just kind of looked down in it, and nothing down there, hell man, just it was probably about 8-10 feet deep. And I just turned around and started to walk away, and I heard something in the leaves, like running. And I turned around, and whatever it was came up out of the ditch and directly toward me at a very high rate of speed. However, I couldn't see it. There was absolutely nothing there, but I could see the effects of it. The leaves were kicking up. The tree branches higher than my head were moving, being swayed. So whatever it was big, and it was headed straight to me. And that's probably the most scared I've ever been. And I took off down the hill about a quarter mile from the house, and I was making so much noise that my mom heard me coming and came out on the back porch to see what all the racket was. And I ran past her, went in the house, and I think I hid under the bed. But again, that was at a time, you know, when I was just really starting to experience things and didn't have a real understanding of it. I would like to think that if it happened a second time when I was 15, same ditch. And I didn't run screaming that time, but I didn't waste any time getting out of there. And I've always thought, you know, if it happened again, I would stand my ground. I would face it down. But when the rubber hit the road and whatever it was came out of the ditch, I'm just like, nah, I'm out of here.
Yeah, that could be enough to shake anybody's confidence. And, you know, maybe I don't really need to know all the answers all the time.
Yeah. But a curious thing about that, years after the second incident when I was 15, probably would have been in my early 20s, I'd gone to a party after work with a guy that I only knew from work and didn't know anybody else at the party. And he didn't know any of my history, anything. We'd only been acquainted a short time. Well, at this particular party, some girls had found a Ouija board under the couch and got it out and was messing around with it. And they started going around the room asking people questions. When it got to me, I thought, I've got a good one for you. And all I said was, what scared me when I was a child with that incident in mind? And the board spelled out WATERSPRITE, water sprite. And they looked at me, and I just shrugged my shoulders, and they're like, what, does it want a drink? Does it want water? Does it want a Sprite? But now this was in the days before the internet, but the next day I went to the library and talked to the reference librarian and asked her what she could find for me on water sprites or water spirits. And she came up with it's depending on who you talk to, it's either an elemental or one of the fae folk. And I can't remember which one it is. There's a naiad and there's a dryad. One is a spirit of the woods and the other is a spirit of the water. But according to the Ouija board, that's what I encountered. Now, the other curious thing about that, on that same property, just a few yards from where that happened, there are 7 natural springs that flow out of a hillside into one that continues on into the lake. So there was a lot of water around there and a lot of woods. So
you not only believe in the spirit realm itself of ghosts and disincarnate human beings, but this world of elementals.
Yeah, I think there's a whole world that we don't see that exists along beside of us, maybe in another dimension or another realm that comes out of the supernatural. And that's where, in my belief, things, you know, like the fae, the fairy folk, the old mentals, Bigfoot, aliens, all that could be from that realm. And sometimes it happens to pop into ours, or a portal opens up. I mean, who knows on that part, but it makes a good as explanation as anything else I've heard.
Let's examine a little bit more about your life and your strange world, and then we'll start dipping into the strange things in the woods aspects and some of the newer stories that you've collected. You know, having had these abilities and again working on them, having these experiences of your own, has it ever been considered like a curse to you? Have you ever wished you could just shut it off and be done with it?
Yeah, there are times, particularly, you know, if you're trying to go to sleep and there's rapping at the wall, or it sounds like somebody moving around in the house, or see a shadow figure or something like that. You know, sometimes it is just like, you know, leave me alone. I'm trying to watch TV. I'm trying to go to sleep. But again, it is what it is. And I don't think it's anything that you can necessarily turn on or turn off. It is what it is. And that I deal with it. I accept it and live with it. And it doesn't always make me happy, but you know, there's interesting parts to it too, especially that I have an interest in the paranormal. At least I have something to explore when I go out and look around.
Do you believe that all aspects of the paranormal are connected in some way?
I think so to a degree. And the way I've had it explained to me was by, of all things, a pastor, a Southern Baptist pastor. And he said that if you believe in the Bible, that all things that we consider natural were spoken forth out of the supernatural. So it's kind of topsy-turvy, but that to me kind of meant, you know, that things do exist. There are interconnectedness, and whatever things are, it comes from somewhere.
All right. Now, things like, you know, Bigfoot, aliens, do you believe that these, and we're going to get into the strange thing in the woods in a few seconds, but do you believe that these are otherworldly creatures, or are they part of our existence, part of our planet, that are just elementals, like aliens being kind of sky elementals, Bigfoot being earth elemental, you know, wind sprites, water sprites, things like that, being more of an unseen life form that just exists and coexists around us?
Well, I think that's a possibility, because there's different cases, it's kind of different. I mean, there are certain Bigfoot cases where, yeah, it sounds like it's some sort of creature that we're just not familiar with. But then other cases, same type thing is described, but it has more of an occultic or more of a otherworldly influence with it. And same with aliens. I've talked to people that claim, you know, that they are visitors from other planets and other dimensions, and then other people will tell you that they're demons. So, you know, that's one of those, don't really know what to believe or how to believe. But I don't know. I just, for me, the jury's still out on that. There's nothing conclusive either way, and may never be.
All right, let's take a quick break. We'll come back, and then we're going to face some strange things in the woods, a collection of terrifying stories. Steve Stockton, our guest, right here on Darkness Radio.
Hi, guys. I'm Violet Benson. Welcome to another episode with me on Too Dark to Be Crazy. Transfers all of his saliva into my mouth, so I just have to keep swallowing, trying to swallow it as his tongue is just like doing its thing, like all the way down my throat. Mortified. Like, I wasn't scared anymore to admit what I need and to ask for what I need. And I just feel like it's like a whole new dating chapter for me, honestly. I typed in you, and instead of going to YouTube, it went to YouPorn.
Be sure to check out Too Tired to Be Crazy on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and Podcast One.
I just downloaded it.
The links for both books that we're discussing today are on today's program guide, so you could just scroll down a little bit in the description of today's program and get more information and links to Steve Stockton's books, Strange Things in the Woods, A Collection of Terrifying Tales, and My Strange World, both which came out earlier this year. Let's start to dive into some of the terrifying encounters. I've never been an outdoorsy kind of guy. I mean, I was when I was a kid. I didn't mind running around playing outside. My grandparents owned 40 acres out in Alabama, and I spent a lot of time, you know, running with my BB pistols and you know, playing Lone Ranger and Tonto with my cousins out there, and kind of wholly unaware of the creatures and the things that are out there. You know, it was just a place to run and play until I became aware of things like the snakes and alligators in the back ponds. And, you know, that then I became acutely aware of the weirdness. So I slowly just started pulling back and have never been a big fan since of just trudging around out there. And then you start hearing these strange, terrifying tales, Steve, that, you know, people are having. What about this topic made you decide to put pen to paper and start to collect all of these stories and share them?
Well, I love the stories. I love talking to people and hearing their stories. And a lot of the people that these stories came from, especially some of the older people, I'm talking people in their 70s and 80s, they were kind of reticent to talk about it, even for fear of ridicule. But then when they understood that I was genuinely interested and wasn't just going to make fun of them, they would open up and tell a lot more. So it's just said, I love legend tripping. I love hearing the stories and the lore and visiting places where things have happened, even if it was just a singular occurrence where somebody saw something one time. I like to go there and just kind of bask in the atmosphere and the ambience, if you will.
All right. Well, let's start taking a look at some of the creepy stories that you've collected for this book. And where do you want to leap off?
Oh, gosh, we can go any direction. I've got the regular scary stories. Got some cryptids in there, some that turned out to be humorous, some that appeared supernatural and then actually weren't. So I've tried to cover all the bases.
Yeah, let's look at those. Let's cover a couple of the things that appeared to be supernatural, but we're not.
Yeah, there's one story in the book called The Light in the Coffin. And it's about a guy who was a young man at the time and was dating or courting, as they call it in the South. He'd been over at this girl's house sitting on the porch in the evening. And when it came time to go home, he had a pretty good hike along the road, maybe a couple miles. So he decides to cut through the woods to save some time since it's late and farm chores start early. So while going through the woods, off in the distance there to one side, he sees what he thinks is a coffin with a light in it and scares the guy. I mean, again, this is in the South, one of those portents or warnings or omens that we talked about. He runs home, gets to his house. He's scratched and torn his clothes on briars and things, and he's in an absolute panic. Tells his folks what was going on, and his mother must have been a lot like my grandmother because she just commences wailing, you know, that there's something bad's going to happen, he's probably going to die, and on and on. And finally, his dad, who was the voice of reason, stands up, and he's like, I've had enough. We're going to go back, and we're going to find this coffin with the light in it. So his dad literally drags him back out in the woods. They take the same route that he took, and they're off in the distance again. He sees it like, Dad, there it is. Well, the father wades into the woods there to go for a closer look at it. All of a sudden, he starts laughing. He comes back, and he's like, son, come here. Come over here with me. What it was a piece of a rotted log that had fallen over. And inside the opening of the log there was a lightning bug or firefly caught in a spider web. So it wasn't a coffin. It didn't have a light in it. But his mind had filled in the blanks and scared him. And he said that if my dad hadn't dragged me back out there and showed me how ridiculous I was being, he said, I probably would have died from fright. I would have given myself a heart attack.
That's unbelievable, right? Well, I mean, it is the false evidence appearing real, right? Those things, those moments when you feel like, you know, hey, I'm in a dark area. It's the woods. It's something scary. You know, anyway, if you've already kind of got that leaning going into it, of course, your possible experience of something being misunderstood to terrify you even more is going to be so prevalent. What were some of the other encounters that turned out not to be so supernatural after all?
Oh, there was another where a guy was a hunter and he was out on this property where he hunted. And he had sat down under a tree to take a break, and there was some rocks piled up there. And one rock kind of shuffled or moved a little bit, and it made a strange noise, something under it. So he moves the rocks and finds a rather large aluminum briefcase. And he thinks, oh, man, this is probably, you know, money or drugs or who knows what. It's wired shut. So he takes the wires off of it and breaks the lock, opens it up. And it's the skeleton of a dog, and there's a piece of paper inside that has a poem, and it was somebody's favorite hunting dog that had passed away. He wrote a poem to the dog and then took it out and put it in the woods where the dog liked to hunt with him. So that one, you know, just it was more touching than anything, but the guy thought, you know, I found something great here. There's only a few like that. I tend to go more for the spookier, unexplainable stuff. But I sprinkled a few of those in there just to show that there are, you know, sometimes things can be explained or not everything's a mystery.
Yeah. Yeah. And then you find something like that, but it's still strange. Why put it in a case like that?
Yeah.
Just right.
Who knows?
Yeah. You do what you got to do. Well, now let's start examining some of the more, let's talk about a couple of the anomalous cases that you can't really pinpoint what exactly is taking place or what type of phenomena it might be.
Yeah, well, and this is obviously human in origin, but as to what extent or what intent. We were talking about tarot cards. A friend of mine was hiking in the Jefferson National Forest in Virginia. It's close to the Appalachian Trail there. And he noticed off trail there was a tarot card nailed to a tree. So he walked over to take a look at it, and looking beyond it, he sees another, and kind of followed him along, and there were several nailed to trees. And he got spooked and left, and he couldn't remember what the cards were to see if there was, you know, some sort of inherent meaning or something there. But again, that's just strange. You know, why would somebody nail tarot cards to trees in the middle of a national forest? And, you know, there may be some sort of trail marker, some sort of devious activity going on in the woods. I've got some stories like that where people found sites that were obviously being used either in jest or in all seriousness for some sort of ritualistic type stuff.
So this was some kind of ritual that was taking place, but do we have any concept, you know, knowing that area and knowing the history and the people that live there, any idea what this might have actually been?
No, not on the tarot cards. Now, the other one I was speaking of, it's in also in eastern Tennessee, and a guy was just out meandering around in the woods, nothing better to do, and saw what looked to be a trail marker, followed it, and it eventually led to a site where there was a giant pentagram made out of logs, and then a log or wood altar set up by that, and then the remains of a deceased animal that had been burned in the middle of it. So again, you know, was it a bunch of heavy metal kids having fun out in the woods, or was it some sort of serious cultist? Who knows? But when he got back to his car, somebody had taken mud and written the word beware across the windshield. So he left and didn't visit that area anymore.
Do you have, an understanding as well of the people in that vicinity? You know, are there different religious sects? Are there people that have been kind of cut off from normal life that might be doing these things to maybe try to scare off, you know, people wandering in? Or, you know, I know back in the day, a lot of the scary woods stories came about from bootleggers.
Yep.
Right. They would create these ghost stories and tales of the woolly boogers and boogermen and, you know, creatures out there to keep you from going into the woods where they hid their stills. Do we think that a lot of these stories germinated that way, or, you know, do you believe that some of them are legitimately stories that surround real life encounters with unseen forces?
Yeah, I think it's a little bit of both. The moonshine still scareaway stories probably aren't as prevalent anymore as they once were, especially in the South. But yeah, there were moonshiners that would tell stories just to keep people away from their stills. And it wasn't always necessarily something paranormal. I had a relative who moonshined a little bit, and he made up a story about a rabid dog.
And a relative, Steve? A relative? Yeah. Or is it like I have a good friend who did what?
No, it was a relative, not real close relative. I won't name any names. He's deceased anyway. But yeah, he had a still out in the woods in Tennessee. But yeah, he made up a story about a rabid dog in the area to keep people away from the still. And that worked, particularly back during that time when this happened. This rabid dogs were a thing to be feared. And it was almost kind of an urban legend of the day.
I'm just trying to, you know, wrap my mind around some of these aspects as well with the, you know, kind of scarier tales. Was it always ghosts, kind of forlorn, angry ghosts in the woods, or, you know, would the stories kind of revolve around more of anomalous, we don't know what's out there, but something is stalking these wooded areas?
Yeah. Well, I know another one, and this one is really unique. Now, this guy was also running a still, but he didn't make up the story to scare people away. That when he went out to visit his own still, he saw a ghost of a headless woman, and he gave up moonshining right there on the spot. So, you know, that's
well, had he been dipping into his own stash?
No, he didn't drink. He just sold it.
Likely story.
But, and he encountered that on more than one occasion, but that he considered that a warning to himself to, stop his evil ways and get his life right. So he gave up the moonshine, went back in the daylight and busted up the still. But then another time he was staying at his mother's house and heard somebody coming upstairs. His room was upstairs. And he thought it was his mother, and he looked out the doorway, and it was the headless woman again. And he said that time he just covered up his head and prayed. And then when he looked again, it was gone. But it was whatever that was after him. Now, as far as I know, he never beheaded anybody and buried the body in the woods or anything like that. But it put him on the straight and narrow. Like I said, he quit moonshining. And then after the encounter at his mother's house, he started going to church on Sundays. So
I like how you have to kind of set it by saying, not that I know of. You know, my friend didn't behead somebody and leave them in the woods that you know of, but you didn't completely dismiss that possibility.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think it's anything he would have done, but he probably wouldn't have confessed that to me anyway. But just the way he told the story, you could tell that he didn't know why this apparition was after him. I mean, if he had obviously done something to create that, then I don't know, maybe he kept more of the story hidden, but I mean, there's anything that can happen in the hills. Get back in there far enough.
That's true. All right, where are we off to next? What's your next strange and terrifying tale from the woods?
Well, let's see here. Another one, it's just kind of a strange thing, not necessarily paranormal, but an old lady that my mother knew, was friends with, and she was probably in her 80s when I was a kid. We went to visit her one time, and she told me a story about a petrified pig. She had an old sow that got sick, and it had wandered off in the woods and died. And she went looking for it, and when she found it, she said it was petrified. She said, I don't mean it was, you know, dried or whatever. She said it was a rock. She banged on it with her fist. And she went back several times and observed it, and then eventually she went back and it was gone. And so the spot was still there where it had laid. There was like a, you could tell, indentation in the ground. And she thought that maybe somebody came and took it, and it's probably in a sideshow or something.
That's bizarre. Well, what would
cause a pig to petrify? But
yeah, she, what would cause that to happen?
A very religious lady too, so I know she wouldn't just make up stories or anything, but I don't know what the circumstances were, and she didn't either. You know, she'd never heard, or, you know, even heard of petrified wood and things like that. Well, this was a petrified pig.
That's just straight up bizarre. Really, just a petrified pig, and there's no explanation for it. There's no legend that would kind of explain how something like this could happen?
No other petrified pigs, no words of anybody ever finding anything else petrified in that particular set of woods, but who knows? And we said she swore it was true.
Very bizarre. All right. Now, what about we've had these terrifying encounters in the woods. What do you know? Any bizarre tales with that you could share?
Sure. I've got some Bigfoot stories in there. There's one from, again, this is from Middle Tennessee, the Fentress County area, where a farmer on an adjoining farm to the farm of the guy telling me the story had a fairly serious accident with a chainsaw, and they had to call an ambulance. And he said that it's out in the country, so you could hear it coming for miles because they're running code with lights and a siren. And he said that after the ambulance left, that he heard something in the woods calling that kind of sounded like an ambulance, but he said it was more like a whooping sound. And I actually played what supposedly a Bigfoot howl for him, and he said, that's it, that's what I heard. So maybe the ambulance stirred it up, and there, that particular area, there have been sightings of Bigfoot over there.
And it's weird, right? Because we know that animals, dogs, will try to sometimes imitate those sounds as well. Mm-hmm. What is this kind of creature that's trying to make itself known? What is it calling out because it thinks the other animal is wounded and it's trying to communicate? Is it hurt? Maybe like an infrasound to them when something that loud and piercing comes through the woods. Is that why it's mocking it or calling back to it?
Yeah, just boggles the mind. But see what else cryptid wise. There's a story of a lake monster in East Tennessee. Two boys were messing around a cove where the lake kind of came up into the little area there, and they said it looked like a sea turtle, except the size of a Volkswagen, and it was just kind of bobbing up and down in the water. And one stayed to watch it, the other ran to get a camera, but by the time he got back with the Polaroid, whatever it was gone. And as far as I know, that was the only time that was ever seen. But what on earth? You know, this is an inland man-made lake, and a turtle the size of a Volkswagen.
What? A turtle the size of a Volkswagen.
That's what they claimed they saw. I just wish the kid with the Polaroid had gotten back a little sooner. Maybe have some kind of proof of it. You know, that's always the way it happens. Many people there are that even now, you'll have cell phones with cameras in them. There's not any good clear pictures of anything, or rarely.
Well, and here's the problem. When you do get a good clear picture, people don't believe it anyway, because then it's too clear.
Then it's Photoshopped.
Right. It's kind of a tough deal to get around. I happen to be fascinated with those type of stories where there's these large creatures that people are seeing. But I guess, you know, I mean, people release animals into the wilderness as well. You know, could it have been a tortoise? Could it have been something that to them looked, you know, ginormous, but was really a natural animal that was just living in that area?
Right. And so that's a possibility, but as far as I know, never seen again. And yeah, that would be the other mystery. How did it get there? But there was a time in the 1950s where kangaroos were spotted in different parts of the Midwest, and even down into Kentucky and Tennessee. And somewhere that I've seen a clear picture of a kangaroo bounding through a cornfield. Now, where'd those come from? How did they get there? Is that a true cryptozoological occurrence, or?
Well, in that sense, it's not really even cryptozoological. It's a zoological anomaly. It's an animal in an area that it's not supposed to be, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, we know kangaroos exist. We know black cats exist. We know, you know, the black panthers, which are actually, I believe, black jaguars, exist. They oftentimes appear in areas that don't seem like their normal ecosystem.
Yeah. Now, right? That happens a lot in East Tennessee. There was, when I was a kid, I remember every now and then, usually in the summer or fall, there would be stories of a big black cat that was around that was taking people's livestock or anything. Well, the black panther, the black jaguar, whatever, it's not indigenous to that area. So if there are some there, how'd he get there? But there were sightings. There were people that, you know, saw it bond through a trash can, and it was, you know, as big as a person, but it was a cat, some sort of just pitch black wildcat.
What are our, you know, everybody loves a good Bigfoot story. What kind of strange Bigfoot tales do you have?
There's another in there, and there's also in the Jefferson National Forest where the tarot cards were. Guy was pelted with stones. And I've had that happen in around the same area. And I've heard the tree knocks and the whoops and yelps and some of that people attribute to Bigfoot. But the stone throwing, and said I've experienced that firsthand. The rocks just came out of the woods, and they seemed to fly in a straight line. They didn't arc. There was no parabola or anything to them, so it wasn't like somebody was lobbing them. And I couldn't feel them hitting me, but they were hitting me. The only way I knew what it was when they hit the ground, I could hear them. And I picked one up, and it was almost hot to the touch. And they came from several different directions. And they weren't, maybe the size of a silver dollar or so, but, you know, a river rock, round river rock. And normally you think, well, thrown that hard, it would hurt. But, again, I didn't feel it. I just heard them hitting the ground. And I don't know. This, when I picked it up and it was almost hot, I thought, something's off here. So I got out of there.
Why do you think these things are, you know, spirits maybe, but why do you think other creatures and anomalous phenomena is drawn to you so much?
Again, I don't know. I think it's maybe that moth to the flame thing, because it's I've had just normal animals. I mean, if I'm out in the woods, deer, wild boar, if there's anything like that around, it will come to where I'm at. And I'm not a hunter. I've never been a hunter. I like to do my hunting with a camera. I just never had the heart to kill anything. Now, I come from a big family of hunters on both sides, but I just never could do it. And I think maybe it's they know that I'm not a threat and they'll come to me. I've had birds come up and eat out of my hand and squirrels and things like that. So I'm kind of an animal whisperer.
Yeah, I was going to say, you just have some kind of innate connection to this environment and to that area.
And that's another thing, you know, that makes me glad that I'm not a hunter. But if I were, they probably wouldn't come around me. I think animals have a sense sometimes of, you know, who they can trust and who they can't. Dogs in particular, you know, dogs are a good judge of character, I think.
What are a couple more of the more terrifying tales as we wrap up today's program?
There was one about some sort of monster, some sort of being or entity in the woods. This kid was coming home from school, took a shortcut, and he heard something coming through the woods and thought maybe it was his older brother who worked nearby at a sawmill. And yelled out his brother's name and didn't hear anything. And then all of a sudden there were some small pine trees there, scrub pines. He said this thing that looked like a ball, a round ball, about 5 or 6 feet tall, but it was striped like an old pair of overalls. It rolled up kind of on top of the pine trees, and he said it was almost like it saw me, and then it just rolled backwards out of sight, and then he heard it continue on through the woods. Again, he thought it was his brother trying to scare him. He's like, I don't know, you know, what he could have assembled or come up with that would look like that. But he took off anyway. Got home, his brother had been home for hours and was sitting at the table eating dinner. So no idea what anything like that was. That's the ones that I love, the ones that are just so anomalous, that are so unimaginable or indescribable. I mean, I can understand an animal or some sort of hybrid animal maybe, but a giant striped ball rolling through the woods in the middle of nowhere, what on earth is that?
Yeah, really, what the hell? And now, what do you make of something like that? Do you believe that that's alien in nature, animalistic? What do you think?
I don't think it was animal, but by it having seemingly intelligence, it would have to be some sort of alien or some sort of entity. And especially like if you delve into some of the Native American legends, like some of the Cherokee legends from that part of the country, there's all kinds of things out there. I mean, you have spear finger, you have the hide behind, you have, you know, all the, and there's some that they won't even talk about because they have this fear that if you talk about it, you can bring it to you, almost like a tulpa, you know, that just by speaking about it or even thinking about it, you can give it power to appear to you. And that's why a lot of the elders in the indigenous peoples, there's certain things they just won't talk about.
Because it like empowers them, or maybe it's like once you speak their name, it like demons, it becomes aware of you.
Yeah. And you wonder about that because there's been other similar reports. Walter Gibson, a gentleman who wrote the old Shadow radio plays and dime novel pulp magazines and stuff, he would have people observe Lamont Cranston, which was the character that was the Shadow, appear in his apartment in New York. He lived in a multi-level apartment, and he would have people over for dinner, and they're like, you know, who'd you hire to put on the Shadow, get up with a slouch hat and the big trench coat and the scarf? And he said, no, whatever that is, it just shows up here. And he thought that it was because he had spent so much, you know, literally blood, sweat, and tears working on these hundreds and hundreds of hours scripts and radio plays and things that it actually summoned it forth somehow. It makes you wonder, you know, what's going to show up in Stephen King's house, you know?
Oh, God. Yeah, so I wouldn't even want to fathom that concept. Holy crap. That's terrifying. That's terrifying. So he writes and creates this character, but then it makes you wonder, did he really, or was there something?
That's the other side of that. Was there something that came through and was influencing him and said, and described me, you know, or said, you know, this is what I look like. I have a black cat. It almost sounds like, you know, the Hat Man or some of the Shadow People type stories. And again, that's some of those, like the Slender Man. Now, that started out on the internet as just a legend, but then people actually started seeing it. And then you had the little girls that were going to kill another kid to sacrifice the Slender Man. So, you know, you get that point in there where things kind of blur between what's made up, and sometimes if you make something up, it can become real if you put enough thought into it, maybe. Again, that's the idea of a tulpa.
Right. Boy, that's remarkable. I'd never heard that story before about Walter Gibson and his visitations of the shadow. And did he just live with that phenomena? Did he ever say that it affected him?
Apparently it didn't bother him or didn't influence him, according to him, but it was common for him to see it. He's like, oh, yeah, it lurks around. I see it on the stairway and upstairs and things. And just,
oh, no way. Yikes, that is bizarre. Very cool stuff. Steve Stockton, again, the books Strange Things in the Woods, A Collection of Terrifying Tales, and My Strange World. We have links up to his books on today's program. Steve, it's been great catching up with you again. Hopefully it won't take another 5 years to connect.
My pleasure, Dave. I'm happy to come back anytime.
Very cool. We'll be back again Tuesday with another brand new edition of True Crime Tuesday. And this is, again, we're being visited by a friend of ours from the past. Steve Jackson will be with us, folks. And we're going to be talking about a case that has really haunted him and been a major fascination. The book called No Angels, The Short Life and Brutal Death of Brandalene Rose Duvall. And we'll be touching base about that book. And then next weekend, we are back with more of the best in paranormal talk radio. We'll have more supernatural news and parashare. But we've also got a unique story, stranger than fiction, punk rock and UFOs. That's next week, right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave. That's Tim. This is Darkness Radio.